So here we are. This is the first lecture in Chapter 5. Chapter 5 is Money and Banking, or Money in the Federal Reserve. I think the name of the chapter in the book is Money and Banking. I changed the name of this chapter, but anyway, it's on money and banking and the Federal Reserve, which is our central bank. So the first slide says, what is barter? It says here that the practice of trading one good or service for another. Now, the reason I start talking here about barter is if it weren't for money, and that's what we're going to talk about here, about what money really is. If it weren't for money, then how would we be able to exchange goods and services? And the answer is the only other way is through the process of barter, where you trade something for something else. You know, several weeks ago, I went to a play at the Barter Theater in Abington. Now, why do they call that theater the Barter Theater? Well, because it was started during the Depression of the 30s when people didn't have much money. And so the theater would accept goods like, you know, a chicken or, you know, a dozen eggs or, you know, whatever. I mean, they would accept goods in kind for a theater ticket. And so they called their theater the Barter Theater. Now, that's possible. I mean, you know, that people can exchange goods and services through the process of barter, but it's very inefficient. And it's inefficient because it requires what is called a double coincidence of wants, which is a situation in which two traders are willing to exchange the products directly. So in other words, with barter, you have to have something that someone else wants, and they have to have something that you want. That's what's called a double coincidence of wants. Okay? And that's not so easy. Or, you know, maybe you've got a cow and someone else has eggs. Well, how do you exchange, you know, how do you do that? I mean, how do you exchange cows for, you know, a cow for eggs? I mean, it's just, you know, barter is, I mean, it's possible in a very elementary way, but barter is very inefficient. See, so what money does is it eliminates the necessity of barter. And it's, of course, a whole lot more efficient. So what is currency? Now, there are some economists that... see, I've got a $20 bill here, and there are some economists that don't call this money because it's really not money in a true sense. It's currency, but it's not money. And I explain the difference to you, but currency is anything that can be used to signify someone's credit and someone's debit in a financial transaction. Now, if you really think about it, if I were to give you this $20 bill, what would that action represent? Well, if I gave you this $20 bill, then physically we could see that you're $20 better off and I'm $20 worse off. I'm $20 poorer, you're $20 richer. Correct? I mean, is that if I give you a 20, you're 20 better off, I'm 20 worse off. Well, anything that does that is currency. Anything that signifies someone's credit and someone's debit in a financial transaction is currency. Okay? Now, it doesn't have to be physical, like when you use your debit card to buy something. It's just a debits and credits. I mean, if you go to the grocery store and you buy something, you know, $100 worth of groceries, well, what happens? Well, your account is debited by $100 and the grocery store's account is credited by $100. See, it's just credit and debit. And that's all currency is, credit and debit. Someone is credited, someone is debited. Okay? So anything that does that, you know, can be that can be considered currency. And what are the four functions of money? Well, when I mention money, the most common understanding is when money is used as a medium of exchange, right? I mean, you can go and buy, you know, a fairly good meal with $20. So, in fact, I went somewhere last night and it was pretty close to $20. So I, you know, I gave him 20, and you know, I got, you know, dinner. Well, I'm using money there as a medium of exchange, but that's not the only function of money. That's not the only function of money. Money can also be used as a unit of account. For example, if I say that a new BMW is valued at $40,000 and a new Ford is valued at $20,000, then what I'm saying to you is that the BMW is twice the value of the Ford. Now, notice here that I'm using money as a unit of account. I'm not using it as a medium of exchange, but I'm using it as a unit of account. You know, it's a way for us to place value, or I should say, it's a way for us to place relative value on things. Okay, if the Ford's 20, BMW's 40, the relative value of the Ford is half that of the BMW. Okay, using money as a unit of account. But money can also be used as a store of value. I better turn off my cell phone. Store of value. See, you know if you can put money in the bank and you can keep it there, like either in checking or savings, but whatever you do, you're using money as a store of value. And the other function of money is that it's a standard of deferred payment. And what that means is that let's say that you use your credit card to make a purchase. Now you're going to have to pay back this money. Especially, let's say that you carry over balance on your credit card, so you don't pay it off in full every month. So you make a purchase with your credit card, and therefore, from the instant you use that card, you begin to pay interest to the credit card company, because credit cards charge interest on a daily basis. In fact, some charge interest on a minute by minute basis, and every minute that you don't make that payment, you owe more interest. All right. So let's say you've got a credit card, and let's just keep it simple. Let's just say that they charge interest on a daily basis. That every day, if you don't pay that money back, you owe X number of dollars in interest. Well, how is all that calculated? I mean, okay, you use your credit card. The interest rate is, you know, 15%. You don't make a payment on that purchase for, you know, another maybe 20 days. Well, how much interest do you owe? Well, that's where money comes in. See, I mean, by using money, we can calculate exactly how much you owe. And how much do you owe, by the way? I've talked about this before, but it was, I think, quite early. This is not, well, just to give an example, but it's something you really ought to know. Again, let's say you carry over a balance from month to month. And let's say you make a purchase with your credit card. A day goes by. How do you calculate how much interest you owe? Well, it's really quite simple. You take how much money you owe, and you divide by 365. Now, I'm assuming here that the credit card company is charging interest on a daily basis, and they happen to use 365 days as a year. So if you owe $1,000 and you don't pay back that $1,000, how much interest do you owe the second day? Well, 1,000 divided by 365 is X amount, and that's added to the amount of money you owe, and that's how much money you owe the second day. Well, how much money do you owe the third day? Well, now you owe more than you did originally. So however much you owe, divide by 365, that's the interest you owe, and that's added to the total. And that process continues until you make the payment. So, you know, some people think, well, if they get again, this is only true if you carry over a balance from month to month, because if you pay it off every month, well, then you're not paying any interest. But if you carry over a balance from month to month, then you're paying interest every day that you don't make a payment. Okay? You owe interest on the total amount you owe. And so if you get a credit card bill, and let's say it's the first of the month, but the payment's not due till the 15th of the month, does it make a difference if you make a payment now or wait till maybe the 10th or 12th of the month? Well, yeah, it makes a big difference, because every day you don't make a payment, you owe more interest. Anyway, that's just a little personal finance thrown in here. This is something that I talk about a lot in my personal finance course, but it kind of fit in here. And these are things that, living in this world that we do, I mean, some of these things are pretty basic, and you should understand it. Mostly just that you're not be taken advantage of. So what is a medium of exchange? Okay, well, I got ahead of myself here. So let's see, store of value, deferred payment, and what are properties of money? Money has to be scarce, of course. Now, what does scarce mean, right? Scarce in economics means there's not enough for everyone who wants it for free. That's what scarce means. If there's not enough for everyone who wants it for free, then we have to have some way to determine who gets and who doesn't get. And, of course, that's the price mechanism. But the more, here's a $20 bill, and, here's a $1 bill. The value, what helps give, the one value and this 20 value is its level of scarcity. Well, I mean, one reason that this 20 is worth more than this 1 is because there's fewer 20s in circulation than there are 1s. See, 1s are more scarce than $20 bills. So 1s are less, have a lower value because there's more of them. There's fewer of these, so this has more value. In fact, in this case, it's worth 20 times more. Okay, so the level of scarcity, when money becomes more scarce, then the value goes up. If money becomes less scarce, the value goes down. Now, if you understand that, then you understand what causes inflation. Because if we increase the money supply more than we increase goods and services, and so much in economics is always relative to. It's not an absolute, but it's relative to. So here, I'm saying that the money supply increases relative to any increase in goods and services. And if that happens, then the value of each unit goes down. I mean, if anything is, if money was so plentiful, I mean, if these dollar bills were so plentiful that they were just laying all over the place. I mean, you just walk outside and it's fall now and leaves are starting to fall, and if money was like that, and if we could all go out there in trash bags and just scoop up these dollar bills, well, how much value would each dollar have? I mean, if money was that easy to come by, then the value of each unit would be very, very low, correct? See, that's what causes inflation. When countries increase the money supply more than they increase goods and services, then everything else being equal, the value of each unit goes down, and therefore, when you and I go to the store to buy something, it takes more units, and that's what we call inflation. Now, this is a question that I really can't answer right now without going, too far afield from the topic. But for several years now, our Federal Reserve, and by the way, our government cannot create money, okay? But our Federal Reserve, which is not a part of the government, can create money. But the Federal Reserve and the federal government act in cooperation, unison. So the way money is created in our society is that the government sells bonds to the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve creates money to buy those bonds. Now, how does the Federal Reserve create money? Does the Federal Reserve have a printing press? No, only the Treasury has a printing press. See, the Treasury of the United States government has a printing press, but the government can't create money. Only the Federal Reserve can create money, but the Federal Reserve doesn't have a printing press. Now, there's a mind teaser for you, right? So how does the Federal Reserve create money? Well, money in our society is just zeros and ones on a computer. That's all it is. It's just zeros and ones. It's all digital. So what the Federal Reserve does, since the federal government uses the Federal Reserve as its bank, essentially, to keep it simple, when the federal government sells, let's say, $1 million worth of bonds to the Federal Reserve, the Federal Reserve can just push a few keys on a computer and it can credit the government's account by $1 million. And now the government has $1 million more money in its bank account, and then it can write checks against that. Now you might say, well, where'd that money come from? And the answer is from nowhere. Nowhere. It's created. See, that's what creation means. It makes something from nothing. It's just like let's say you go to the bank and you've got $100, and you deposit your $100, and the bank teller makes a mistake and credits your account by $1,000. Now, can you go out and spend $1,000 from your account, and is that real money? And the answer is yeah. You got $1,000 in there. You can write checks up to $1,000. Those checks are honored, and therefore that's real money. Then you might say, well, but I only put in 100. They made a mistake. They credit my account by 1,000. I spent 1,000, but where'd that money come from? And the answer is from nowhere. It was created. See, money can be simply... See, man can't create. I mean, everything we see here was not created by us. I mean, we took raw material and we changed the form into chairs and doors and lights and all that. See, the human beings cannot create except money. That's the one thing that we can create, to make something from nothing. Yeah.
So you're saying that the whole concept of money is an abstract idea?
Oh, yeah, that's kind of scary, isn't it? Yeah, the whole concept of money is a very abstract idea. See, that's why it only has value if we believe it has value, period. Because it's only digital. It's only ones and zeros. It takes a great deal of faith So let's say to get a paycheck for $1,000 and then take it over to your bank and you give them your check and you walk away. Well, that takes a lot of faith, right? They say, oh, well, the bank's going to keep track of that, and I'm going to be able to write checks against that, or I'm going to be able to withdraw it when I want. I mean, you've got to have a lot of faith in your bank in order for you to do that. And yet our whole banking system, our whole society is based on that level, a high level of belief. That belief subsides and the whole thing doesn't work because nothing is real. See, our money's not real. It's just fiat money. It's not backed up by anything. There's no gold or silver, nothing that backs up our money. It's just ones and zeros on the computer. Okay? And that's true for the whole world, by the way. It's a very fragile system. An extremely fragile system. A lot of people think that, well, you know, what we've got is going to be here forever and it's strong. No, it's not strong. It is fragile. It's weak. Anyway, where was I? I got all that from scarcity. What I was going to say is, all right, what brings about inflation is if the money supply becomes less scarce, in other words, there's more of it, therefore, the value of each unit goes down, and therefore, when you and I go to buy something, we have to pay higher prices. And then what I said is, well, we have been creating money, billions of dollars of money, multiple billions of dollars of money for several years. For several years, every month, the Treasury sells bonds to the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve, through the practice of what we call quantitative easing, that's the name we give it. See, if the government sold bonds to the Federal Reserve and the Federal Reserve used existing money to buy those bonds, that's not quantitative easing. That's not monetizing the debt. What monetizing the debt or quantitative easing is, because those two terms mean the same thing, is that when the government sells bonds to the Federal Reserve and the Federal Reserve creates money, that's what's called quantitative easing. And that's what we've been doing for years. Well, if we've been creating huge amounts of money, why don't we have more inflation? And I can't answer that right now. But there, in a couple chapters from now, we'll get into exactly, maybe sooner than that, but I don't want to get into that, but it's an interesting story of why we haven't had more inflation than we have, despite our major use of quantitative easing. Anyway, another property of money is that it has to be portable. You know, it's got to be something, you know, like these dollar bills. You know, something you can put in your pocket and you know we can carry around. That's what's called portability. And the other is divisibility. Well, that means that, well, a money supply has to be like, you know, there are $100 bills and there are $50 bills and 20s and 10s and 5s and 1s, and then we get into coin and see, that's what we mean by divisibility. So these are the three properties of a good workable money system. Now, what is commodity money? Anything serves both as money and as a commodity. So commodity money means that it's backed up by something. You know, in the colonial days, the most popular form of money was backed up by tobacco. In fact, that's still true. You know, even during World War II, the major source of currency in the prisoner of war camps was cigarettes. So if you're using cigarettes as a medium for exchange, well, you can smoke a cigarette or you can use it as money. And that's what's called commodity money. See, is this $20 bill here commodity money? No, because the only thing these are good for, well, I guess you could use them for wallpaper. In fact, that's what they did in Germany. You know, it was cheaper to use German marks, you know, for wallpaper, or it was cheaper to use bundles of German marks for firewood rather than using money to buy firewood. I mean, you could bundle German marks together tightly and throw it in the fire because that was less expensive than going out and using the money to buy firewood. Or it was cheaper to wallpaper your walls with money than it was to go out and buy wallpaper. I mean, that's what happened in Germany during the 1920s. And Zimbabwe in more recent years, I mean, it's, you know, there's plenty of examples of how countries have experienced high rates of inflation and therefore, but the point I'm making here is that for all practical purposes, I mean, you know, most people, you know, wouldn't use this for fire, to burn fire or wallpaper. I mean, for all practical purposes, the only reason that we would, this can't be used for anything other than a medium, you know, a currency. And therefore, it's not commodity money. Okay? That's the difference between this and commodity money. Okay, what is token money? Money that exceeds the value from which it was made, for example, quarters. And, you know, I don't have a quarter on me, why would we not want the metal content in a quarter to be worth a quarter, or certainly more than a quarter? Well, see, if the metal content in a coin was more, the value in the market was more than the face value of the coin, then people would simply melt down the coins and sell the metal. So if the silver, for example, if the silver in a quarter was worth more than a quarter, it wouldn't take very long before we would have no quarters. Right? I mean, people are smart. I mean, why use quarters if you can melt them down and, you know, you can use, you know, that's more profitable. So token money is... see, if you melt it down a quarter, there might only be maybe 2 or 3 cents. I mean, if that, of metal. I mean, the value of the metal is next to nothing. But yet, a quarter is worth a quarter of a dollar because, well, we say it is. So we believe it is, therefore it is, which is true for almost everything. Again, it all gets down to belief. What are examples of money? Federal Reserve notes. You see, this here, if you notice across the top, it says Federal Reserve note. Now, what is a note? A note, by definition, is an IOU. In other words, what this is saying is that it's hard to explain, but this is not real, okay? Because what this $20 bill says here is that the Federal Reserve owes you $20. See, it's a debt. See, our whole money system is based on debt. It's not real. See, this 20 doesn't exist. The only thing that exists is that the Federal Reserve owes me $20. It's debt. Now, if I went to the Federal Reserve and I said, okay, you owe me $20, so here's a $20 bill, well, they would just give me another $20 bill, maybe. Okay? I mean, this stuff gets wild if you really think about it. All right? It's just funny money, really. So anyway, that's what a Federal Reserve note is. Now, what helps give these bills here, this currency value, is that it says here, on the left-hand side, it says here that this note is legal tender for all debts public and private. Now, what does that mean? Well, what that means is, let's say that you owe me $20, since I got a $20 bill. And you give me a $20 bill. Let's say you gave me this bill. And I said to you, I don't accept this piece of paper. I mean, we call it paper, but it's really not paper. You know, it's linen, it's cloth, it's not really paper. But I'm not going to accept this as a payment for your debt. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you still owe me $20. Or it could be $1,000 or $5,000. Now, if I do that, I say, no, you still owe me the money. What can you do in turn? Well, what you can do is you can go to a court of law. Now, what's a judge going to say? Well, the judge is going to say, yes, you did pay your debt because us, the law of the land, recognizes these pieces of paper payment of debt. And that's what helps give this currency here value. Now, it says here, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Well, what I just explained to you is a private debt. But what's a public debt? Well, public debt is what you owe government. So, by what's right written on this currency here is that you, if you owe the government a certain amount of money, they are obligated to take this as payment of debt. Now, try to do that. I mean, if you owe, let's say you do your taxes and you owe, $500, and you just put $501 bills, in an envelope and send it to the IRS, what's going to happen? Are they going to accept that? They're not going to accept that. All right? But by law, they should. And you might say, well, if it's law, I mean, if it's written right here, what's the deal? Well, the deal is that a lot of times things are written, but if an authority chooses to ignore what is written, then who's to say otherwise? And that, unfortunately, has become very common in our society, where authorities have violated what's written, the law, and just done whatever they want to do. You know, they've superseded the law. But if the people have no recourse or they have no wherewithal to take recourse, then, well, that's what happens, you know. I mean, a lot of things are not legal. In fact, our whole income tax system is not legal if we really look into it. But the government still imposes it on us. But I'm not going to get into that. Well, that'd be a can of worms. What does the term liquidity mean? The easier something is to spend, the more liquid it is. The more difficult it is to spend, the less liquid it is. Liquidity is a very important concept in economics. In fact, it's one of those terms that I explained way back in the introduction of the book. But the easier something is to spend, the more liquid it is. So liquidity is not... one can be very wealthy, but not liquid. See, liquid, they got nothing to do with the extent of your wealth, only the form of which you hold your wealth in. You know, some of the wealthiest people in the New River Valley are farmers that have been here, families have been here for, 100 years or more, and they own a bunch of land and buildings and farm equipment, and they were very wealthy, but a lot of them, are not very liquid, meaning that they don't have much cash, okay? So liquid is Now, the reason this is important in terms of money in banking is that what you're going to learn is that the Fed Reserve can only influence the money supply by influencing the liquidity of banks. They can either take action to make banks more liquid, or they can take action to make banks less liquid. Now, you can understand this as we go along, but liquidity is a very important concept. Which form of money is most liquid? Well, that depends on the circumstances. Now, you might think that, you know, these dollars are liquid, but, you know, try to pay your taxes in dollars. Or try to rent a car with dollars. Or if you're in a big city, try to pay your hotel bill with these dollars. In those cases, these dollars are not liquid at all. You know, you can't rent a car with bills, with dollars, currency. So, in other cases, they are very liquid. You know, this is very liquid. I mean, you can go to the local store and buy things. You know, you can go to a restaurant and buy a meal, and, you know, the merchants will accept these as payment of debt, payment for your bill. And so, in that way, they're liquid. So the form of money, the liquidity of money, depends on liquidity. Sometimes credit cards are more liquid. Sometimes checks are more liquid. I mean, it just depends on the circumstance. By the way, technically, are credit cards money? Credit cards are not money. Is a debit card money? Yes, a debit card can be used as money. Now, what's the difference? I mean, you know, you go to a store and use a debit card or use a credit card, it works the same way. Well, the difference is, in our definition of money, money has to be able to be used as a store of value. And when you use a credit card, that's not your own money. You're borrowing someone else's money. So there's no store value there. And therefore, technically, credit cards don't represent money. But debit cards do, because debit cards, you have to have money in a savings account. You have to have savings in the bank in order for your debit card to be honored. So debit cards are money in a strict sense, where credit cards are not. So, what is fiat money? Money not redeemable for any commodity, its status as money is conferred by the government. You see, this is fiat money. Okay? This is only money because the government says it's money. Period. Okay? It's not backed up by anything. No gold, no silver, no nothing. Okay? That's called fiat money. Now, later on in the course, we're going to talk about the gold standard and in our present fiat system. But let me make a point here. The gold system would be a system whereby currency could only be brought into circulation if it was backed up by gold, or it could be silver, or really something else, but normally you think of it as gold or silver, usually gold. And so if we were on the gold standard, could the authorities increase the money supply at will? And the answer is no. Because under the gold standard, if you want to increase the money supply by 5%, then you've got to increase your gold holdings by 5%. All right? Now, Is that true on a fiat system? No, it's not, because under a fiat system, the authorities can create as much money as they want anytime they want. Now, here's the point I'm making. Would a fiat system be as strong as the gold standard if the authorities stuck to if they only increased the money supply according to some set rules or in accordance to something, would that fiat system be as strong as the gold system? And the answer is yes. Why, you know, the fastest growing currency in the world today is Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a virtual currency that it's not created by government, by any government, but it's a worldwide currency. It's a virtual currency, but it's becoming very popular because people would rather have it than American dollars. Now, if American dollars is the fiat currency and Bitcoin is the fiat currency, because it's not backed up by anything, why is the world turning to the virtual currency like Bitcoin and away from government-issued money? And the answer is Bitcoin, even though it's a virtual currency, maintains its value because it can only be brought into existence through a very definite pattern the way Bitcoin comes into existence is that people play these mathematical games, and the winners of these games are awarded a certain amount of Bitcoin, and that's how Bitcoin comes into existence. But the point I'm making is that there is a certain format that has to happen in order for Bitcoin to come into existence. So Bitcoin maintains its value even though it's a virtual currency, whereas national currencies like this dollar do not, because these are brought into existence willy-nilly. There's no set format of which these can be brought into existence, as is the case with Bitcoin. Y'all find that interesting? See, that's what's going to replace many economists believe, that these will not be around for too very long, all right? Because, I mean not only American dollars, but currencies of other nations, many other nations, because they're all doing the same thing. We're all nations, almost all nations are on the same song page. And they're creating money willy-nilly out of just thin air, and they're doing it to a very large extent. And eventually it's going to destroy the money system. But we have to have a money system, and so what will replace it could be a virtual currency like Bitcoin. Now, y'all find that interesting? Well, it gives me something to think about. I've lost it. What is legal tender? A currency that constitutes a valid and legal offer of payment for debts. That's what I read on the left-hand side. You see, it says that this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. That's what legal tender is. It's a valid legal offer where, the courts, the law of the land backs it up by law. Does gold or silver back up our money? And, of course, now you know that it does not. It did at one time, but, we went off the gold standard, and that's something we're going to talk about later, exactly the process. When we talk about the Federal Reserve, what happened in 1968? U.S. and a number of European nations stopped selling gold on the London market, allowing the market to freely determine the price of gold. And so what happened is that, What happened is that 1968, the gold standard as we knew it was very weakened, but nations were officially, when one nation did business with another nation, they honored payment in gold until 1971. In 1971, Richard Nixon, President Nixon, closed for good, put the final nail in the coffin of the gold standard. Now, there wasn't much of the gold standard left, but what was left of it was brought to an end in 1971. From 68-71, only central banks could trade with the U.S. at $35 an ounce. Finally, in 1971, even this bit of gold convertibility died. See, what Richard Nixon said in 1971 is that we are, the United States is no longer going to honor an exchange of the dollar for gold, period. So why does money have value? If I say, you know, why does this 20 have value? I could say, why does that door have value? Or why does this computer have value? Or why does that chair you're sitting on have value? Anything has value for the same two reasons. Anything has value because, number one, it's useful, and number two, it's relatively scarce. I mean, the only difference between this currency here and that door is that they have different uses. Period. That's the only difference. You see, some people think that there's something special about money. There's nothing special about money. It's just something that has value because, number one, it's useful, and number two, it's relatively scarce. Period. It's just the only difference between this dollar bill and that door is that they have different uses. Period. There's nothing special about money. Okay? It's useful and relatively scarce. And once it becomes not so scarce, it becomes less valuable, like anything. What determines the value of money? Well, what really determines the value of this money is the price level, right? I mean, what can you buy? You know, like, you know, we're close to the mall here. We're actually part of the mall. So if you walk out into the mall, what can you buy for $20? Well, whatever it is you can buy, that's what determines the value of this $20, right? It's the general price level that determines the value. If the general price level goes up, what happens to the value of this money? It goes down. Why are banks called? Now, this is where we get into the second part of the chapter. Now we're going to start talking about our banking system rather than money. So this would be a great place to stop. Next time, you know, we come in, I'll start talking about our banking system. I think you're going to find it very interesting. So let's call it a day, and I'll see you all next time.
I wonder how strong Bitcoin is when paired with its revolvers.
Wait a minute. Let me stop this. Stop this. Okay, now what was that question?
How strong is Bitcoin when compared to the dollar in terms of its value? You know.